Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema
and of ambient noises that are all around us.
Yes, today's a windows open, ceiling fan on kind of day.
I was considerate enough of the listeners to turn off the very loud box fan.
Yes, and we did close the front door.
To eliminate the whirring noises of every air conditioning window unit. Within a 100-foot radius.
Of them that have one. So you're welcome, listeners. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I am a film reviews editor at The Wrap, co-host of the Who Shot You podcast on Maximum Fun, and of the Young Turks' What the Flick. And joining me, as always...
is...
I thought you were going to introduce yourself.
Mrs. Alonzo Duraldi. My name is Dave White. I am a film critic, too. I write also for The Wrap. Alonzo Duraldi is my boss. Also married to me. But that's not why he's my boss.
I've never been your boss.
He's never been my boss in this house. I know that. You are my editor, though.
I guess. The Wrap. Yes, I suppose so.
As much as I allow you to edit.
Well,
me.
When you're not looking.
Listen, I don't need editing. Every sentence out of my fingers is golden.
Yeah, well, English major, you could learn a thing or two about a colon, is all I'm saying. Anyway.
Do I use too many of them?
No.
Not enough.
I just pulled,
too few? Too many?
I pulled that piece of punctuation out of the ether. I don't really have anything to back it up.
I'm a big fan of the semicolon. I know that.
They're great.
I do use frequently, I use the semicolon frequently because I know how.
Yes. I'm a believer in them.
And because
when you
I like a good long sentence.
Sure, Victor Hugo. Conjunction, junction. What's your function?
I have a review that's due for you this week, I think.
Yes, the McQueen documentary.
The Alexander McQueen documentary.
Get on it.
I got to get that. I'm seeing it, what, Tuesday?
You tell me. I don't know.
I don't know. My laptop's shut down. I don't even have my laptop.
Well, get it together and turn it on time. I don't want to hear excuses from you, mister. So, Scarlett Johansson.
What is her dang deal? Why?
It's like, it's not enough that I'm going to re-team with the Ghost in the Shell guy. I'm also going to play a trans man, because...
Playing an Asian-identified character was not
such
enough.
Such a hit with
not
everyone.
Not enough. But here's the thing. For me... Her response to it was also very weird, and I think I understand her response in the way that, well, let's just explain what's going on, because what's going on.
So, quite a few trans people in the industry and critics and observers
and me
noted, and you know, others too, but like I'm giving them the voice here.
Yes.
That this is ridiculous. This is what Hollywood always does. This needs to stop, because and I think frankly the many strong arguments on the table here, Hollywood doesn't cast trans actors in non-trans roles.
No.
So if you're going to cast cisgender actors in trans roles, you are effectively like blackballing an entire community from ever working.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, so yeah. That's just on the most pragmatic level of it all. Obviously, there are a lot of other ways to approach this, in which is also 10 kinds of wrong.
So, I'm just gonna for a second tell you what I think their argument is going to be in favor of this. The producers, her, right. You know.
Well, she gave her statement that was...
Her statement is some nonsense, but I also think I know where she's coming from on that. So I'm going to talk about that first and then say, and then explain why all of this is completely bad and wrong.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to guess that because this story, this true story about Dante Gill, mm-hmm. a trans man who ran a series, who ran a chain of massage parlors or something like that.
The movie's going to be called Rub and Tug.
Right. This is not a story that happened, you know, 2 years ago or is happening now.
Right.
This is a period story. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, the terminology was different then.
Queer people of all categories had different words to describe themselves, different words to describe each other, different words to discuss themselves with the mainstream public, if and when they did.
Right.
And so they could very, if they were savvy, they could hide behind... You know, well, you know, was this person trans or did he even
just a butch
did
lesbian?
He ever call himself trans? Like, yeah. I don't, and because I don't know about this person, Dante Gill, I don't know how he described himself, other than that he gave himself a man's name, and therefore, I'm gonna just assume,
yeah,
that if he was walking around in the world, he was saying, hello. My name is Dante Gill.
Yeah.
I'm a guy.
His pronouns were he, him.
Yes. So, the other thing I think they're going to go with is the artistic freedom argument.
But Scott, it's an actor. She should be able to play anybody.
And her statement to the press about, why don't you talk to all these other men who've played transgender women,
and
Felicity Huffman
and
who played
Leto
a trans woman as well.
For Tambor, yeah.
And so,
my favorite response to that, by the way, came from one of the performers from Transparent saying, the fact that you would reference Jeffrey Tambor, who got fired from his job for sexually harassing several trans women, shows you have no interest in this community that you're itching to portray.
There's a thread on Twitter that I would like to read.
Okay.
It says everything pretty much the way I... I'm feeling.
By whom?
A woman named Erin Brooke.
Mm-hmm.
She spells her name E-R-Y-N-N.
Okay.
She's an actor.
Okay.
I don't know her, but she's an actor.
What's her Twitter handle for people who might want to look
Erin Brooke.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brooke with an E at the end or no?
No.
Okay.
No. She references a stage director named Robert LePage.
Yeah.
I don't know this person.
Canadian,
okay.
Very big deal, though. I think it's Robert LePage, actually. I think he's Quebecois.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm going to say Robert LePage because that's all I know.
Okay, fine.
All right. Forgive me, Quebecois people who don't like my pronunciation. I feel silly trying to sound French when I'm no good at it.
Well, you tell that to Isabelle Huppert.
I can say Huppert because that was how I was introduced. Okay, Robert LePage. I did it. I've succeeded.
You're so continental.
I always feel like a goof when I'm trying to say French things because I'm doing it wrong. I'm always doing it wrong.
You're not. You're good. Right.
So between the Scarlett Johansson mess and the LePage mess, I think maybe we need a quick brief on how acting works because a lot of people are arguing for artistic freedom and they're just plain wrong.
Oh. Does she mention what the LePage raises?
She continues,
okay,
yes.
Sorry.
For those who... Yeah, this is a thread, all right? Okay. So this is going to take a second. She continues. For those who aren't aware, the Robert LePage show at Montreal International Jazz Fest was canceled following protests because it featured a majority white cast in a self-described theatrical odyssey based on slave songs. And Scarlett Johansson is under fire for her upcoming role as Dante Gill in Rub and Tug. Dante Gill was a trans man, and ScarJo is a cisgender woman. The counter argument you'll hear from folks, including LePage, are about artistic freedom. and how acting is about identifying with other people, and why can't actors just do that? Because that's their job. And well, I was an actor for a good chunk of my life, so I will tell you. The nuance isn't that difficult, really. It's about the difference between acting and performing. Acting is a craft. It's honed in many ways. Performing is acting for an audience. In working on your craft, you can do and pretend all kinds of things. You can try scenes and monologues and songs you would never perform. You can experiment with roles you will never play. You can do whatever you want to build your craft. It's for your craft. When you're performing, you are not in service to your craft. You are in service to the story. You are using your craft, the skills that you've honed in acting, in service to the audience. Performing has different responsibilities. One of my favorite pieces in working on my craft is "And I Am Telling You" from Dreamgirls. The technical skill required to sing it, the endurance, and the emotional depth and flexibility makes that song an Everest. I would never perform it. I would love to. I love that song. I love singing it. I would never, ever perform it because just by being white, there's a big part of the story of that song that I cannot communicate to an audience. It doesn't matter how well I can act it. My performing it doesn't serve the story. Can I act it? Sure. I can act it every damn day in my living room, in my shower, in my head, whatever. I can act anything in my own space on my own time. When an audience is involved, however, I'm not just acting. I'm acting for an audience. I'm performing. I must serve the story. The question isn't about whether or not someone can act a part. It's about whether or not they're being cast in that part to perform a specific role, in this case, a historic one, serves the story. The answer for both Scarlett Johansson and LaPage is no, it does not. Now, some might say that we cross-gender cast Shakespeare all the time. Why is that okay and not this? And the answer is actually quite simple: time and exposure. How many of you know who Hamlet is? And now, how many of you know who Dante Gill was before this movie was announced? Shakespeare has been part of our mainstream cultural lexicon for centuries. Dante Gill has not. The stories of Shakespeare are etched into our brains like fairy tales. Dante Gill is not. It is irresponsible to tell his story in this way. The performance doesn't serve the audience. Shakespeare is also a difficult parallel because his works were written originally for all male, all white casts who would play women and darken their skin to play Othello. Women couldn't perform before 1660, and in 1662, King Charles outlawed men from playing women's roles. So the cross-gender casting of Shakespeare's works actually comes from a long tradition of subverting expectations and legalities on performance. It's political, not a whim of artistic expression. And sometimes that crucial thing can be updated or turned on its head for modern audiences in service of the story, like Hamilton. The crux is political. It's the identity of immigrants. Could you cross racial cast Shakespeare for political reasons? Sure. If a white person is going to play Othello, make everyone else not white and see the story from that lens. Would it work? I don't know. It's up to the people doing it to make the choice that serves the story. Could a white actor learn Othello's monologues in order to better their craft? Sure, why not? Could they get paid to play Othello alongside an all-white cast? It has happened. Does it serve the story? Not very well. Scarlett Johansson is plainly one of the best money-making actresses in the international market. Her name on a movie brings in money. You say ScarJo is in your movie, and funding comes in. It doesn't matter what the story is. Investors just want a return, and that's what she gives. But the political message of a cis woman playing a trans man in a story that is not common knowledge is that trans identity is not important to the story, and that's a problem. It's choosing money over art. It is not in service to the audience. It's using them. And actors are very well aware of what they can and cannot play in front of an audience. It's drilled into them. You're too tall, too old, too fat, too quirky, too busty, too loud, too blonde, whatever. We know that we can act in certain things that we will never perform. It's okay. It doesn't matter how much I want to sing "And I Am Telling You." It doesn't matter if I can hit every note, every riff, every emotional nuance. I can't serve the story to an audience. I can act it, but I cannot perform it, and that's okay. And for the devil's advocates out there, no. Not even in a cross-racial production of Dreamgirls. Because blackness is key to that story, and I am not black. Whitewashing Dreamgirls sends a political message that doesn't serve anyone except people who want to do it because it would be fun. In this case, I think we can argue for both. Scarlett Johansson could still be in this film as a different character.
Exactly.
Use her name to support a trans actor in the role. In terms of the LaPage thing, could a mainly white cast singing traditional slave songs serve the story? Maybe. It would be hard. But he's made it clear with his statements that that's not what he was doing. He's distanced himself from cultural appropriation conversations. He's using artistic freedom to mean doing what he wants because he feels like it, not making a political statement, which is what it means. Someone responded to the thread with, well, are we just going to get to a place where only aliens can play aliens and only zombies can play zombies?
Oh, God.
And her response, trans people are not zombies or aliens. They are people and they walk among us.
God. No, and that's totally true. Hang on, there's a couple more.
She has the star power to push for marginalized people to have better representation. Clearly, she's allowed to act in this movie. She's doing it. Does it serve the story in the best way possible for our current political climate? Nope.
Yeah, and I've heard that, well, they, you know, to get the movie made, they've got to get, you know, they need a name. And right. It's sort of like, okay, well, you know what? There's never going to be a trans name if you don't give high-profile trans roles to trans actors. Because,
correct,
again, they don't cast trans actors in cis roles, which they should. And then, as our friend Matt Zoller-Seitz said, he tweeted, about the ScarJo thing, I don't agree that if they don't cast a trans actor, the film won't get made. That ignores Hollywood's long history of casting around the unknown new actor.
Yep.
Gandhi, The Color Purple, Basquiat, Lawrence of Arabia. I could go on all night.
There are lots of trans male actors out there. Find him.
Yeah, exactly.
Find that guy.
Yeah.
Because he exists. He's out there somewhere.
And let Scarlett Johansson play...
Y'all are so good at these. We auditioned 40,000 girls to play Little Orphan Annie in the Annie musical movie. And what was her name? I don't even remember her name.
Aileen,
but like, yeah, it was such
something.
A big... It was Quinn. Such a big to-do.
Why do I know that?
They can totally do that. They can do it. They can do whatever they want.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if Scarlett Johansson wants to use her clout to get it made, sign on as a producer, play like a key supporting role. But no, this is Oscar bait.
Yeah.
You know, and...
I like her.
Yes.
I like her a lot, and I want her...
to knock it off.
I want her to knock it off. And I want her publicists to step in and help her.
Yeah.
Because this has now reached the publicity...
Epic tone deafness.
This has now reached the level of, why is your publicist not helping you here?
Yeah.
Why are you...
digging this hole even deeper.
Why are you digging yourself into this hole, and why is no one helping you dig out?
Yeah.
Because this could be a moment for her to learn about this and to do the cool thing.
Yes.
And get this movie made with her name attached, because she's A-list.
Of course.
She is A-list.
She's an Avenger.
And this could all get done because of her, and she would end up being like
the hero,
you know what I mean?
By like, giving a talented trans actor this plum role.
Yeah.
Scarlett Johansson is too hot for this nonsense.
Did you say Scarlett Johansson is too hot for this nonsense?
No, I said it's too hot.
It's too hot.
It's too hot. I can't deal with your nonsense when it's this hot outside.
Yeah. It's a heat wave, you guys.
A tropical heat wave.
Uh-huh. Yes. Speaking of that heat wave.
Yes.
I went to the Arclight on Friday when it was 111 degrees outside.
And moved in.
And I stayed there. It just so happened that I had not seen the week's releases.
Mm-hmm.
And I had said to myself, I will now wear a pair of shorts that I will usually never wear outside.
Mm.
And I will wear a short sleeve shirt with the buttons wide open. I was serving body on Friday.
You were resort wear.
Anybody who ever...
The category is resort
Anybody
wear.
Who knows me knows that I do not run around the world, like, bearing flesh.
No.
But I was on display on Friday. I was so determined to sit in that air-conditioned building for as many hours as I could. And I hate double features.
Yeah, it's true. You complain about that.
Sitting for too long makes my fat legs hurt. And so, because I'm 1,000 years old. But I was in it. I stopped in at the Veggie Grill. That has nice air conditioning.
Good.
It's right next to the Arc Light. Had that Filipino adobo chicken bowl, C-H-I-K-I-N.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's...
chicken with an apostrophe
it's,
in there.
It's not, it's actual like, meat. It's some other kind of textured protein that is...
I will say, their...
Flavored like chicken.
Their fake chicken is
pretty good.
Is eerily convincing.
Yeah.
They're giving... It's giving chicken realness.
Yes. That adobo bowl has so much nice stuff, and it's got that brown rice, roasted tomatoes, diced cucumbers everywhere, these long green beans that you have to cut up so you can put them in your mouth, because otherwise it's like green snakes coming out of your mouth.
Like Davy Jones.
Yeah. So it's that was a good lunch in a nice, cool place. Our friend Brian was with me. And we went to see Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Sing it. Sing it.
That's what these bugs do.
Young people. Back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson, legendary songwriting team for many Motown hits.
Yes.
Didn't they write Ain't No Mountain High Enough?
Probably.
They wrote You're All I Need to Get By, and they wrote everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had their own hit single as a singing duo.
Oh, wait, I kept thinking it was Peaches and Herb. Was that Ashford and Simpson?
Husband and wife. What are you saying?
I thought Solid was Peaches and Herb, but it was written by Ashford and Simpson.
God.
Okay, sorry.
No. Peaches and Herb sang Shake Your Groove Thing.
Yes.
And Reunited.
Yes.
Reunited and It Feels So Good. Okay, that was their... They had two hit songs.
That was it. Okay.
Peaches and Herb, as adorable as they were, they were no Ashford and Simpson.
Well, no.
Ashford and Simpson are like the secret kings of songwriting. They were like the royal couple.
They're the Carol Kings of songwriting.
Yeah. Like, they name a song on the Motown label.
No,
they
I
probably
know.
Wrote it.
They are the R&B Burt Bacharach and Carol Bayer Sager. I get
it. They had a hit single of their own.
Yes.
Called Solid. Solid as a rock. Bum, 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 bum.
And then,
that's what this love is.
Yeah. The thrill is still hot, 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 hot. Glenn Weldon from the pop culture.
It's not a song I like. I have never liked that
song.
I have literally always disliked Solid as a Rock.
It's just always just sort of been there. It's like,
it has always been
there. It's like not liking Mount Rushmore. It's just
there. Well, I don't like Mount Rushmore much either.
Anyway, Glenn Weldon of the Pop Culture Happy Hour made a joke about singing Ant-Man and the Wasp to Solid. And so
and we haven't stopped doing it for the past 6 weeks.
We need to.
But I declare moratorium on it today.
Oh, really?
We are finished doing that.
Okay.
At least until the end of the year, when we are forced to talk about the year in cinema.
Mm.
Yes. And then we may reprise it.
Yes, and maybe when Avengers 4 comes out. But beyond that...
Maybe. But for now, let us lay that joke to rest. Let us not kill it with too much love.
Fine.
Okay. Let's smother it with a nice gravy instead of our affection.
Actually, when people eat ants, they're covered in chocolate, right?
I don't know. I've never eaten an ant.
Nor have I, but it's a thing that happens.
Do people still do that? Do they still eat ants?
I think some people never stopped. I mean, I think there are cultures where that's just a thing that you do. I'm not talking about it in like a fear factor kind of way.
I know.
People actually eat ants.
I understand that. But I mean, like, the trend, there was a momentary sort of like, oh, look, it's the new thing, chocolate-covered ants.
Well, yeah, I'm sure in United States urban centers it may have had a moment and then that moment passed, but I think there are just places in the world that people eat ants.
There are.
Yeah. But I, you know.
I don't know what those places are right off the top of my head.
Nor do I know the specifics of how they are served.
Yes.
Anyway, that's where I was going with this. Ant-Man and the Wasp, what'd you think, Dave?
It's fine. It was fine.
I like the idea of there being a corner of the Marvel Universe that's just sort of like not the end of the world, you know, that takes place not just on a literally smaller scale, but I mean just where the stakes don't seem as crushing. But the thing is,
the stakes don't seem like anything. Well, in the anime movies, it reminds me of the sitcom Too Close for Comfort. Like if that were a Marvel superhero movie, that would be Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Because he's under house arrest?
Yeah, because this takes place like in a house.
I mean the thing is, like, I think these movies would feel more like a breath of fresh air if jokiness weren't such a key component of most of the Marvel movies anyway.
Already, yeah.
You know, we have the Guardians of the Galaxy. Now Thor is wacky. You know, like, yeah. There's a
and
lot.
Thank God. No. Honestly, Ragnarok is the best
Ragnarok
Thor movie.
No, Ragnarok is terrific.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, there's a lot of, like, hook-a-da-doo, you know, in the Marvel Universe already.
Hook-a-da-doo?
Yeah, I just made that up.
Wait, can you do that again?
Hook-a-da-doo! You know, so, like, if the rest of the Marvel Universe were more sort of, like, somber and Zack Snyder-y, right. And the Ant-Man movies came along, were like, this sort of breezy, woohoo, you know, then, yeah, it would feel like a bigger deal. But given that there's already so much of that breeziness in these movies, it's sort of like, eh, okay, they're kind of designed to be whatever, and they're whatever. You know?
He's under house arrest for some reason.
Civil War.
Because of Civil War, because he got big and... Because
he was on the...
I can't remember.
Because he was on the anti-government side. He was with Cap and not with Iron Man.
Right.
And so part of the deal was...
Why is he under house arrest but no one else?
I think everyone else is a fugitive or something.
Oh, okay.
It's hard to keep up.
These are the details that just past me.
Look, there are whole websites that will explain this to you. I am not capable of that. But yeah, so I think... Well, that's the other thing. Scott Lang, the Paul Rudd character, is kind of the one person in the Marvel Universe who is neither, like... you know, a billionaire or a deity.
Yeah.
You know, or I guess a teenager like Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So he's under house arrest and hanging out with his daughter, and his kooky ex-con buddies are all opening a home security company. And then he has a dream that involves Michelle Pfeiffer, who is the long-missing Janet Pym, wife of Michael Douglas's Henry Pym character.
Yes.
Who got lost in the tiny quantum subatomic universe.
Yeah.
Which Ant-Man went to in the previous movie and maybe came back with some sort of message from her. So he gets in touch with Dr. Pym and with Hope, Evangeline Lilly, who are themselves on the lam as well. And then they try and figure out how they can rescue Michelle Pfeiffer and also keep the Pym shrinking elements out of the hands of an arms dealer played by Walton Goggins, and
who's fantastic,
who's a lot of fun, and a character named Ghost, who is sort of phasing in and out of reality and needs to figure out how to save herself.
She has a problem.
Yeah.
Her molecules or her atoms keep shifting.
Yeah, they're phasing in and out.
And it causes her constant pain.
Yeah.
And so she wants, you know...
the gizmos.
She wants that fixed.
Yeah.
And I don't even think of her as a villain, really.
Not really.
Like, I was kind of... I sat through the movie thinking, well, you have a reason. You have a good reason to be unhappy.
Right,
you know?
And I think that the way, and without spoiling anything, I think the movie is sort of more interested in setting her up as a character who we're going to be seeing recurrently.
I would like that.
Yeah.
I would like that because I thought she was probably the interesting character in the film.
You know, what's fun about the movie is they play around a lot with not just sort of shrinking and growing, you know, Ant-Man and the Wasp, but also like... cars and buildings and Pez dispensers.
Yes.
And you know, in my review, I basically said that this was in tone very much like a 70s live action Disney movie, like one of the Dexter Riley movies with Kurt Russell. Like, it has that kind of goofy $1 million duck quality, but just with way better special effects.
Kids, this is one that kids will really get into.
Yeah.
Because it's so full of those get huge, get tiny surprise moments, which apparently are all in the trailer.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't watch the trailer.
I heard someone yesterday complaining about how all that stuff is in the trailer and that there wasn't anything that the film held back from the trailer.
Don't watch trailers, y'all. It ruins everything.
So I liked Hannah John Kamen. She was Ghost.
Yeah.
That she was the most interesting character in the film. I thought Walton Goggins was really cool and really funny, but he's kind of like that guy you hire when you just know that he can knock it out every
to
single
do that
time.
Exact thing. Yeah.
He's like the dude.
M.M. Walsh.
He's like the dude Joan Cusack. You know, like
yes, you know exactly what you're getting, and you're going to get it.
You
real
know
good.
You're going to get like the best person in the world when you get Joan Cusack in a movie, unless you're relegating her to a useless, you know, part.
Yeah.
And then you get, and then you deserve not getting
the Christmas
the
train.
Best from her. Yeah. But I liked Michael Pena.
I liked him a lot more in this one than in the first one.
Yes.
I found him annoying in the first one, which is rare because I usually think he's really good, but he gets a comic monologue in this one that is hilarious.
It's a very drunk history, sort of presentation as well, because his comic monologue is then, as he's talking, everyone else in the movie is speaking with his voice, explaining the monologue. Like, the monologue is going on, but he's talking, but everyone else is, you know, mouthing the words. And it's very much like an episode of Drunk History, and it's very funny.
Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah.
Always good.
I liked T.I. As one of Pena's associates, and I don't know the other guy.
David, it's some...
I've seen him before.
It's a Russian name.
I'm blanking on his
name.
He's
very funny. It's come up a lot on Flophouse, so as soon as I saw Ant-Man, I texted Elliot Kalin, and I said, you will love the fact that there is a running Baba Yaga joke in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
And there's a funny gag about Morrissey.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah. I forgot about that.
So, well, maybe I like this more than now that I'm talking about it. I guess maybe I think it's more than fine. I think this is, like, pretty good.
Yeah, I had fun. I think it's better than the first Ant-Man movie. I think it is, you know... And frankly, it's nice to have a Marvel movie... Yeah, and we get them every so often. It's not like they're inventing anything here. Where you aren't constantly thinking about five other movies and how we got to this point and where we're going next. You know, there is some connective tissue here for Infinity War, but it's, you know, it's not the overwhelming thing here.
If you don't see it, you will not be left out in the dark when it comes to the next Infinity War movie. They will just tell you in the next Infinity War movie what is going on and where Ant-Man was in connection to all of it. In terms of the closing credits, I'm not going to give anything away, but there is a bump after the main titles.
Right.
And then there's another credit at the end of the credits. There's another little scene at the end of the credits, which is absolutely throwaway, and you don't have to sit through 10 minutes of credits if you don't want to.
Yeah, the of the two shawarmas, the first one matters, and the second one is just a gag.
Absolutely does not matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have places to go, you know, you'll be fine.
Right. Unless you have a friend who worked on, you know, post-production in a VFX house.
And you want to...
Yeah.
Their name when it just whips across the screen
when it speeds past your face.
What else did you see on Friday at the Arclight, Dave?
Sorry to Bother You.
Mm.
From Boots Riley.
Yes.
What do you know about Boots Riley?
Almost nothing. Like, everything.
Do you like me to tell you
everything
things?
I know has I've learned about the last couple of weeks, because I don't know his band. I've never seen his videos. I know he's a thing, but he's never been on my radar until this movie.
Okay. You're gonna remember this when I tell you about it.
Okay.
Okay. So, he is the main creative force behind The Coup.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know their music, you will realize that in this film, the characters only listened to The Coup, which is, I thought that was fantastic. And he's actually quoted in an interview that I read as saying, well, this is sort of an alternate universe Oakland, and in this alternate universe Oakland, there's only one album, and it's mine.
And so, why wouldn't all these characters love my music?
Yeah. The Coup is the group that had an album that dropped on September 11th,
ooh,
2001. And the cover art for that album coincidentally showed the World Trade Center towers exploding.
Oh, that was them.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, that album cover art was, you know,
yanked,
created months and months before,
of course, yes, obviously,
that release date. And it if you know their work, if you know The Coup's work, it's extremely political and extremely anti-capitalist. And Boots Riley himself is like an identified, like, he'll say, right, he will tell you, I'm a communist. Like, he does not care. And so that was
a communist with a 3-picture deal.
Yeah. That was a piece of political art,
right,
on the cover of that album. Oh.
Oh.
And then it was supposed to drop on that day.
Right.
Yeah. So it was quickly, you know, pulled.
Is it the kind of thing where, like, if you have it, it's super valuable, or does no one have it?
I don't know. I've never seen a copy of it in person. Hmm. So I don't know how far it made it out into the world. I mean, obviously, there were probably some promotional copies that got sent out.
Right.
You know.
Who was it? Was it Macy Gray who went on some award,
yes,
show with
her album came out on the same day.
My album drops 9/11, like, yeah, on her dress or something.
Yeah, it was her dress. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, anybody who had a Tuesday was the release date.
No? Yeah.
Or is it still
it's still Tuesday.
Do we still do that? Do people still wait for Tuesday release dates for albums?
I don't think they do that. Because everybody gets their albums on iTunes now anyway, so I
don't know. Beyoncé changed all of that.
Well, sure, yeah. Yeah. And now it's like, you don't even tell you have an album coming out. It just
until
appears
the day,
one day.
It just appears, yeah. But so, yeah, it used to be Tuesday.
Yeah.
Tuesday was album release day, and September 11th, 2001 was a Tuesday.
Right.
So all these people had records that came out that day, and those records didn't go anywhere.
Right.
But so anyway, then Boots Riley put out another Coup album a few years back called Sorry to Bother You.
Oh.
And there was a song on it called We've Got a Lot to Teach You, Cassius Green. It was the beginning of this screenplay.
I see.
Yeah. About a man who works in a call center, mm-hmm, in Oakland doing telemarketing for encyclopedias. And he learns very quickly from his coworker, Danny Glover, that to make a sale, you have to sound white. So Danny Glover whips out his white voice for Lakeith Stanfield is the name of the actor.
Cassius Green.
He was in Get Out. Yes. He was the guy
who says Get Out.
Who says Get Out? Yes.
He was also in Short Term 12 and,
yeah,
that movie where he plays a real guy who was wrongfully imprisoned for murder. Crown Heights.
Crown Heights. So, very quickly, Lakeith Stanfield learns that he has a natural gift. He can do a white voice. And in fact, that voice is the voice of David Cross.
I believe Danny Glover's white voice is Steve Buscemi.
Oh, is it?
I think it is.
Okay. Later in the movie, we learn that Cassius's girlfriend, Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson, can do her own white voice, and that's the voice of Lily James.
Yes. And the top telemarketer, who's played by Omari Hardwick, and who we never even find out his last name.
No, they never give you his last name.
He's such a figure of
and
mystery.
And it's never explained.
It's like bleep, yeah. His white voice is Patton Oswalt.
Yeah. So, because Cassius can do a white voice, he becomes very successful as a telemarketer. And they kick him upstairs to the power caller part of the company. And that is where he learns that power callers are responsible for selling horrible, horrible, horrible things. And I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil the secrets and surprises of this movie because they are not only very meaningful in terms of the point of the film, but they're both funny and horrifying at the same time, which is a very difficult line to walk. And this movie doesn't always care if it walks that line delicately. I really love this film.
I like it a lot. We'll be talking about Blind Spotting in the next couple of weeks, which I reviewed out of Sundance. And like both of these movies, I'm very on board for what they're about and what they want to say. And I think that as first films, they have an interesting kind of shagginess to them. And they also have that first film thing of like, I got to get every idea I ever had into this movie because who knows if I'm going to get to make a second one. And I think that so
And I
many.
don't think that's a mistake, but go on.
Well, I'm just saying, but it's a thing that some first filmmakers do. And when I read the unqualified raves of both of these films, I'm thinking, I mean, let's not get crazy here. Like, yes, what they're saying is super important and needs to be said, and I'm glad they exist. There's a lot to like in these movies. There's a lot of really great performances. There's funny stuff. There's horrifying stuff. But and this is a larger thing I see about people get excited about Sundance and they want to be on the ground floor of discovering
Yes,
things,
I get
you
that.
know. And so I and it's kind of like, can we discover them and also say like, there are some flaws here, but the next we're so excited to see what they do next.
I have only read one thing by anyone who said that it did not have flaws. And I think there's no such thing as a perfect film. Jordan Peele, of all people, said he tweeted. Everyone's talking about what the film references are in this movie, but you need to understand that there's been nothing like this movie ever. I was like, "That's not true,
True.
Jordan Peele, and you know that's not true."
And frankly, if we're gonna on the on the level of like first films, neither Sorry to Bother You or Blind Spotting is as cohesive, as narratively cohesive as Get Out was. But again, I don't think they mean to be. I think that the shagginess is a feature and not a bug, and I'm not trying to hold that against it. But again, I just think that everybody needs to like take a breath.
I'm going to address what you're saying first. I get what you're talking about. The scramble to praise something that is
New and different.
new and different and really good.
Yeah, and exciting.
and exciting, yes. You will see people fall all over themselves trying to, get the word out. I don't mind them doing that for something like this because a film like this needs the cheerleaders because it is such a radical story. It is a defiantly anti-capitalist film. And how many of those are there?
No, agreed.
It is also full of, as you said, ideas, perhaps too many, about class and race and what white people expect of black people and what black people can expect from the world around them, from each other.
I'll say this. My only qualm about that level of cheerleading is that you then get a hereditary situation
I understand.
where
I
people
know.
go see the movie and like, well, this is not what I was
Right.
sold, you know. But no, I agree
There's
with you.
always the risk of overpraising something that's good.
But there's, but you're right. It does touch on a lot of interesting stuff, and I like that he uses the phrase alternate universe because I was reminded of Repo Man.
Yes.
In terms of, like, this is a recognizable, you know, present and also a little bit skewed.
Okay. Now, I want you to go shh while I overpraise this film, okay, because I'm fixing to do that right now. As I just said, I love this movie. Here's why I love it. I love it the way, and you talked about this in, maybe in your review, but at least to me, I love this movie the way I love Greg Araki's The Living End. Mm. When I saw Greg Araki's The Living End in 1992,
I think,
in Dallas, in the Art House Theater, surrounded by a bunch of gay Republicans, honestly, I swear that's who was in the audience. They booed at the end of it.
God.
And I felt my head explode. Because I thought, all of you melon farmers need to get out of my life and get away from me, because this is an important thing that we all just watched. Yes, it was made for 35 cents. And the acting, not so great. But a furious film.
Yes.
That changed things in ways that those audience members benefited from later. But if you talk to them even now about that movie, they'd be like, oh, that sucked. Mm. And I would still tell them to shut up. Now, that's the only... The point of comparison here for me is I saw something that felt like it was on fire. It was a loud fire. And that's what this is to me. I'm not comparing the acting in The Living End to the acting in Sorry to Bother You, because the acting in this movie is fantastic.
Yes.
The script is fantastic. Greg Araki was just like throwing bombs in The Living End. Boots Riley knows how to write a script. And he knows how to direct a movie, and he knows how to make it look exciting. It looks so cool. And moves in such a I hate to use the word bouncy because it maybe sounds like I'm infantilizing it, but it has so much energy and so much power that even when things start to pile up near the end, narrative stuff and weird special effect things start happening, that are completely convincing, I didn't care. I was just so thrilled to be along for this ride and with this filmmaker, because I want to keep watching his movies in the future. I want to know where else he goes. This is, to me, like an early Spike Lee film. Clearly, like a Michel Gondry film, like to the point where there's even a Michel Gondry joke in the movie. There's a little animated short within the film. Do you remember this?
Vaguely.
The little animated short in the middle of the film, it says a film by Michel Gondry.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's absolutely that visual, like, reference a point to Michel Gondry's films.
The special effects thing is, I thought, a check that this movie can't cash.
Fine. That doesn't... Again, I don't care.
Okay.
Because that special effect is so freaky looking and so unsettling that it took me in anyway. This film in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 is going to be attacked by right-wing idiots.
Oh, certainly.
And by timid liberals who are scared of
incivility.
Of incivility, yes. And to all of them I say, go F yourselves. I'm fed up. I love this movie. There, I have overpraised it. In direct opposition to you.
Look, if this movie...
The more measured approach.
If this movie has two sides, I will stand with the overpraisers. I just don't want to... I don't want to oversell it, and I also... It's a thing that has driven me nuts at least as far back as Tarantino, where, you know, I think that filmmakers benefit from getting to make a couple of movies where they're figuring out their voice, they're figuring out how they're doing stuff, they work with strong producers and, you know, and really kind of you know, craft their sort of voice.
I know what you mean.
And I think that sometimes when people get crazily overpraised out of the gate, they lose an opportunity to hone and instead just assume that everything they do is going to be great, you know. And that's not good for art.
That is a risk, definitely. But I go back to thinking about someone like Godard, who came out of the gate swinging.
Sure.
And has spent his entire life, now he's, I don't know, he's 11-y now, still making difficult, demanding, wild films.
Absolutely. And I referenced both Godard yes. and The Living End in my review of this
you
movie.
You did.
So yeah, I mean, I unhesitatingly recommend it and people should see it. If I am sounding, you know, cautious, it's only as a balance for what I think is sort of people going bananas about.
I know.
But no, it's terrific. You should totally go see it. And he is saying things that need to be said. And I think also saying things that need to be said right now is The First Purge.
Oh my God. Yes. My favorite Purge. And you know, that's hard for me to say, because how can I choose between great works of art that I love equally?
I know.
How can I?
You're a Purge head.
I am. I loved The Purge. I loved The Purge 2, whatever it was called.
I forget.
I loved The Purge Election.
Right.
This one's my favorite, though.
Will you ever sit down and binge The Purge?
Why would I do that?
I just wanted to make that
no
joke.
Reason. This is from director Gerard McMurray.
Yes.
His only other feature was about hazing in a black fraternity?
Yes, that was on Netflix.
And I forget the name of it.
I knew until you asked me. But apparently he was in New Orleans when Katrina hit.
Oh, was he?
Yes. And apparently that sort of informs his vision here of how the government sweeps in and deals with communities of color.
So one of the ongoing situations in the Purge movies is why. The question of why. And each film that comes along explains a little bit more about why there's the Purge, who organized it, what the government's real reasons are.
Burning Sands.
Burning Sands. What the government's actual reasons are for instituting the Purge.
I remember seeing the first one with you and thinking, there's an interesting story here about why this thing exists, but this movie
but
is
we
not
don't know
telling
what it is. But again, each successive film has given you a few more drops of information.
Yeah.
This one lays it all out.
Yes.
This one explains who invented it. Marissa Tomei, it turns out. Who invented it and why? And who took it and ran for their own purposes.
Right.
I don't want to go any further than that, other than to say the government wants poor people and people of color to kill each other.
Yes.
I just gave it away. Sorry, that's a spoiler. It doesn't matter. The reason why it exists, you were pretty much guessing already by the second, especially the third film.
Well, it's funny because we just watched Attack the Block again.
Yes.
We did a screening of it for Who Shot You. We did our first live show this week. Thank you, listeners, those of you who came. It was great to see you. They talk in the movie about, there's a speech that Moses has about how maybe these aliens were sent here by the government because they already sent drugs and guns into the neighborhood, and maybe they decided we weren't killing each other fast enough.
Yeah.
And so, and the First Purge connects those same dots.
Yes.
It's basically, it's like saying, this is like crack, this is like guns, this is like all the stuff that, you know, that has been supplied by the government to foment black-on-black genocide in the inner city, but now it's the Purge.
Yes.
And when the people living, it mainly focuses on this one sort of, like, again, like Attack the Block, this one sort of set of towers as projects in Staten Island.
Yeah, they very specifically make it only happen in Staten Island, and they directly focus their attention on getting the people in a housing project yes. to participate. And then what the people in the housing project do is have a block party.
Exactly. they got paid for not leaving Staten Island.
Yeah.
But yeah, so at first they're not having it. They just have a rave. And so then the government starts sending in
yeah.
people to...
Okay, don't give things away. Don't give away too much. Don't give away too much.
Anyway.
All right.
They want a purge and they get a purge.
And then people fight back.
Yeah.
In just a beautiful kind of diehard way.
Kind of like the raid I was reminded of, even.
I was reminded of the raid. I was very happy that the female protagonist, Lex Scott Davis.
From Superfly.
Yes.
Which you should totally go see.
Which you need to also totally go see because it's such a blast.
Yes.
She gets... She doesn't get pushed aside.
No.
By the hero guy.
No.
The anti-hero, really, because he's the neighborhood drug dealer.
And they have a past, but she's like super right. activism, and he's the drug dealer.
This is the most violent purge that I've seen.
Really?
So much stabbing in this okay. movie.
I saw one, but not two and three, so.
It's got the wildest camera work of any purge movie I've seen. It might not have the scale of menace and fear of the earlier ones, where it felt sometimes mysterious as to what people were doing and why, because they were wearing masks, mm-hmm. and they seemed genuinely sort of like slow motion psychotic
well,
at times.
I'm imagining in the other movies, you have this whole thing where like everyone around you is a potential threat.
Right.
And in this one, they haven't quite worked the kinks out yet, so a
right.
lot of people aren't taking it seriously and they aren't really, you know.
Right.
Prone to mayhem.
Right. And then, yeah, I'm not going to give away how it ends, but I'm really into this one. This
yeah.
is my favorite one. There's a really funny and weird thing that happens during the closing credits. I'll just tell you what it is. It doesn't spoil this film at all. They show you the commercial for the upcoming Purge TV series.
Yeah, that was odd.
They stop the credits, just like boom, and then like here's the ad for
coming
the show.
To USA Network.
Coming to USA this fall. Oh, I'm gonna watch that show.
Oh, heck yeah! But I think it is reasonable to include the first Purge alongside Sorry to Bother You and Blindspotting.
I think so too.
In these movies that are talking
Absolutely.
About the current state of you know America's you know race issues.
By about the 20-minute mark, I sat there and thought to myself, they use the N-word so much in this movie, there better be a black director. I was like, if this is some, like, yeah.
There is a character who early on who is like, who is just sort of presented as like the most flipped out evil,
uh-huh.
you know, a time bomb waiting to go off.
Don't spoil that either, please.
Well, but I'm just saying,
okay.
but he made me think this better have a black director.
Don't spoil his character's arc.
No.
Because he's,
nope.
he's a surprising
yeah.
figure in
yeah.
the film. Yeah. I had a great time watching this.
I really.
And I think it's worth seeing.
Absolutely. Although one person who didn't like The Purge when we made him watch it at the drive-in for my birthday went and saw it and then told me on Facebook, nope. He was not having it.
He would have seen this one?
Yes. But he also thought it was too violent. And he goes, the 5 minutes of social commentary was not worth all the gore. And I was kind of like, well, the movies kind of exist for the gore and the social commentary is just kind of the icing.
I would like you to now write down the name of that person since you're not going to say it out loud, apparently.
No, I'm not going to put him on blast.
Well, when you write down the name, maybe I'll make that decision for you.
This is a person,
you don't have to cross the T's and dot the I's.
This is a person who really likes
oh, okay.
Doris Day.
Okay.
So maybe the first Purge was not...
This is not his kind of movie.
No.
These are never his kind of movies.
Yeah.
I'm just a guesser.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet. But he went, nonetheless. I appreciate that. And then you, on July 4th, when our plans went belly up...
our plans did go belly up on the 4th, and so you stayed home and watched Hallmark Christmas movies all day.
I did.
And I left the house because I could not stand the idea of sitting around this house all day with you watching Hallmark Christmas
movies. Well, and I wouldn't have been watching them had you been here, because I'm so nice
to you. I went
to
see Santa Monica, to the Lemley Royal, to see Five Seasons, The Gardens of Piet Oudolf.
Okay.
Piet Oudolf is a Dutch landscape designer. Have you been to New York City and visited the High Line?
Not yet.
Well, you should.
I want to. The last time I was in New York City, I was there for 36 hours on my book tour.
Yes.
And it was December.
Yes. You could have still gone to the High Line.
I guess I could have, but I did not.
In your coat and mittens. I was there in July
yes.
of 2009, and it had not been open for very long yet. But the High Line is such a fantastic place in the middle of New York City. It is a park that's long and narrow.
It was a section of, like, elevated railway, right?
It was a section of elevated railway, and they turned it into a place where you can walk and ride your bike, and there are plants and grasses and flowers and benches and all sorts of, you know, things to look at and think are beautiful and to sit and think and just do whatever you want to do. But it's long and narrow because it's built on this old existing train track. Lurie Gardens in Chicago, same kind of situation, not long and narrow, but a garden in the middle of a city. Pete Oldolf is the man who created these places.
Okay.
He's also done stuff like all throughout the world. And this is a documentary about how he makes his gardens. And it takes you through a fall, winter, spring, summer, and fall.
I was about to ask, what's the fifth season?
He's in his 70s now. And it's him visiting different sites, places that he's already accomplished or places that he's in the middle of building. Like the one that the documentary was showing being constructed at the time is, I want to say it's in England, attached to a new branch of a Hauser and Wirth gallery.
Hmm.
Hauser and Wirth, very much like Gagosian, has galleries around, locations around the world.
Right.
And he made a garden for them, and it's gorgeous. And you see how he works. And one of the most telling things he says in the film is, when you're looking at one of his gardens, he says, "This is how you wish nature really was." Like this mix, this wild mix of gorgeous things. And some of them are just like weirdly shaped grasses and weeds and things that you don't see very often because they're not immediately pretty to your eyes. You have to look again at them and just see what they are and how they're constructed. Like, he's been responsible for reviving certain strains of plants that most people just don't think of because they want a lot of pretty pink flowers
right.
in their gardens. And actually, there's a part where he goes to Texas, to the hill country, to look at the wildflowers. And out in Texas hill country, those wildflowers, it'll just be a blanket of red.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see him. And he takes one look at him and he goes, "It's too much." "It's too much. It's I mean, it's real. It's actually happening, but it's just over the top. It's too much for my eyes."
That's Texas for you.
Yeah. And he goes, "For a person like me, this is just too much." He, because, you know, he's just this very sedate Dutch man.
Right.
You know.
It's the opposite of a famine of beauty.
But I want to talk about just the beautiful tranquility of this film.
Well, it seems, given the subject matter, that it would be kind of zen.
Oh, my. It's about 80 minutes long. It might not even be actually 80 minutes long. It may be like 77 minutes or something like that.
Right.
But it feels like a nice long visit with the most calming person that you know. Like, you just want to... And it's just shots of these flowers and plants, and just, it's so peaceful. Like, if you're feeling stressed out by life and this film is playing in your town, just go see it. Like, watch it twice because it's so short. It's beautiful and calming, and you get an insight into how this man works, which is also really cool. I loved this. I just had such a beautiful, you know, moment of no one bothering me. It was me and a lot of really old people. And when you're 54 and you're the baby of the audience,
you're the one that didn't bring their own oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, it's gorgeous.
Cool.
Definitely seek this out. Even if you're just watching it on your TV, you know, get yourself all nice up and close.
Uh-huh.
But if you see it on a screen, it's just like you're enveloped by, it's like in Soylent Green when the old guy is about to die and it's just a field of psychedelic flowers
in front
of
the screen.
On a screen, yeah.
Edward G. Robinson, that's right.
Yeah, Edward G. Robinson.
Well, Dave, tell people about all the exciting new news about our Patreon page.
Oh, why don't you go look at it? Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Today, this morning, I corrected something that I had done earlier and didn't realize that I had done. I posted photos of all the new prizes that club members get for 2018. And then I also posted photos of the prizes that you got in 2017 and 2016 that we still have in varying supply.
Right.
But when I posted them, I only posted them so that members could, people who are already club members could see them. I didn't post them so that the rest of y'all who aren't club members, who don't subscribe to the Patreon stuff,
could take a good long look
at all this beautiful, you know,
merchandise.
That we give you. You subscribe to Patreon at whatever money per month level you choose, and you get extra. You get audio, digital, premium, beautiful content.
Big audio dynamites.
You do, yes. You get LKTV, which is a television podcast. You get Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast. You get Linoleum Nights, which is an R-rated swearing podcast about sex, religion, and politics, and, you know,
and you can't talk about contemporary politics without swearing.
Without swearing, so. Yes. And so,
and also Google Hangouts, and
you get to be in the club meetings.
Yeah.
The club meeting this month, we're going to watch the Barbra Streisand remix of A Star Is Born.
Mm-hmm.
She went into A Star Is Born, her movie.
Her own edits.
From 1976, and she just chopped and screwed.
Yeah.
She fixed the ending, and when I say fix, I don't know if I'm putting that in air quotes or not, because I haven't watched it yet. She did a lot of things.
She did things her way all the time,
darling. So, that's the club meeting. It's going to happen at the end of this month. We're all going to watch it together and talk. Mm. And you get prizes. You get things. We give away, you know, T-shirts, mugs, tote bags, enamel badges.
Magnets.
Christmas ornaments, refrigerator magnets that are related to the food podcast. See how relevant those things are?
Yes.
The Christmas ornaments are relevant because Alonzo Duralde is the author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas and is just generally obsessed with Christmas year-round.
Or as Ricky Carmona likes to call me, el mero mero de Navidad.
What is a mero mero?
Apparently it's like the number one, the best.
Wasn't originally he calling you like el rey
yes.
de Navidad, but now he's calling you el mero, mero mero?
Yeah.
And mero mero is like...
I think it's a play on mejor.
Is that Cuban?
I think it's a Cuban slang play on mejor, which means best in Spanish.
Right.
So the best of...
Because I know there are certain Spanish slang words that come from non-Spain.
Yes. And I don't always know them.
You don't know what they are sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. You only speak that Spain Spanish.
Those are my people.
I know. So, anyway, now you can see all the pictures. Ta-da!
So go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. Behold the beauty of other things and join.
We're at 367 subscribers.
Wow.
But my mind only works in even numbers, and I want there to be 400 people even. Like, I want more... Like, I know it's weird to hear me say this because for the past 6 months, I've been sort of scrambling to catch people up, people who fell through the cracks, people who joined in 2016, 2017, who either, like, never got their stuff, or I forgot, or I screwed up somehow, or I shipped it and it never arrived. Like, we have someone in Ireland who I shipped all their stuff to, and it hasn't shown up yet. And it's freaking me out. And I'm waiting very patiently to hear, oh yes, finally, after 3 months, it finally arrived.
Well, is this like one of those towns where everybody has to go to, like, the corner shop?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. His name's Dylan, and he has the wildest address of any subscriber on Patreon. So, congratulations, Dylan.
We hope your stuff gets to you.
You have the best address of anyone who subscribes to Patreon. But I worry that his address is too complicated for the Irish postal system to meet with the American postal system. Yes, it's very upsetting to me to think that his stuff hasn't arrived yet. It's like out in the ether. Anyway, I know it sounds crazy for me to say, oh yeah, more subscribers, please, but
you're ready.
I'm pretty ready now. Like, I know there are still some people that I'm catching up with, but I'm pretty much ready. I've got all the 2018 stuff sitting behind me on the shelves. It's all going out in July. And, yeah, bring it on. It's not like I have anything else to do anymore. This podcast is my actual job now, handling the business. I barely write a thing right now.
Yeah, so, you know, crowdsourcing is great. Just remember that, like, fulfillment is a full-time job.
It certainly is, and that's my full-time job.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Put Dave to work. What's your DVD pick?
Asiambra.
Okay.
That's the letter A. That's an article in Italian, and Siambra is the other word. I don't know what it means. It's the name of a place.
I was gonna say, it's the town or something, right?
Yeah. This was Italy's entry for the 2018 Academy Awards. It's from Jonas Carpignano?
It's Carpignano? But it also qualified for the Spirit Awards this year, which the rules for that mean that Between the director, the writer, and the producer, like, at least two of them had to be Americans.
I reviewed this for The Wrap when it came out in the beginning of 2018. You could go to The Wrap and read my review. But I really, really like this film. It's the second feature from this director, and it stars a kid named Pio Amato, who was in his first film, Mediterranea. Sorry.
Robert Lepage.
And he's a Romani boy, and it's about his family. And this kid is really in this family. This is his real family in the film. But it's a fictional story starring a real family.
Right.
And it's based in their actual lives. And it's moving and, you know, frightening and upsetting and, you know, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it'll freak you out because you see, you know, little 4-year-old kids getting their first cigarette. So, yeah, it's out on Blu-ray on Tuesday.
Okay.
And I highly recommend it.
Somebody on Facebook asked me what my 5 favorite films of the year so far were.
Oh, they want you to list things already?
Well, no, it wasn't like an assignment. It was just somebody just asking.
Yes.
And so I did sort of 5 off the top of my head, although like I then came up with 2 other ones that I could have easily put in there as well.
I keep a list.
Good for you.
I keep a running list.
Maybe
you should do the same thing. Maybe you should be more like me.
That's never a good idea. But one of the ones that I came up with, which even though I saw it last year, it was released here this year, and definitely on that list would be Andrew Haig's Lean on Pete, which also comes out on Blu-ray on Tuesday. Yes, it is an emotionally devastating film.
It just wrung me out, and I'm saying that as a positive. That's a
good thing.
I'm saying that as a positive recommendation. Like, yeah. I love this movie.
Yeah,
but it put me through the ringer. Yeah.
Yeah, Charlie Plummer, who played the young kidnapped Getty in All the Money in the World, plays a kid who is living with his father, who's kind of unreliable, and winds up befriending this Steve Buscemi, who plays a horse trainer who runs, races horses in these little kind of, you know, out of the way, you know, state fairs and stuff. And the kid gets attached to this horse named Leon Pete, who is going to get sent down to Mexico to basically to be slaughtered. And so he escapes with the horse to try and save it. And things go from bad to worse. Yeah. But it's, yeah, it's devastating, but not hopeless, and really beautifully put together. When I saw it, I had never seen Charlie Plummer in anything, and I thought he was just some non-actor kid that Andrew Haig had found.
Right, right.
Because it's that kind of natural performance that doesn't feel, you know, studied in any way. And, you know, and he's acting opposite, you know, Steve Buscemi and Chloe Sevigny, and it still comes off in this totally natural kind of way. And it's, I really recommend this movie. I mean, yeah, it's going to be, you're going to feel things.
Oh, my, you're going to feel things. Yeah.
But you should totally give it a shot, because it's just so, and Andrew Haig, I just think he's such a great filmmaker. He did Weekend in 45 years and, you know, was responsible for a lot of HBO's Looking. And I just think he is so good with actors and so good with kind of writing these really delicate moments. And yeah, check it out. We have some letters, do we not?
This is from Norma. Hi, guys. I wanted to send you this request for about a year, but have been too cowardly. Would you consider asking Elliot Kalin to be on your show? I first got the idea when I went to the live shows before Elliot left for Los Angeles. I was talking to Charlene at Hinterlands, and she and Stuart were so sad that Elliot was moving. Imagine the little rascals sitting on the curb with their heads in their hands. She was talking about how everyone in Los Angeles is awful. And I thought, I know great people in Los Angeles. So before Elliot left, I suggested that he reach out to you and Dennis Hensley, because I believe that you are all high-quality, A-plus friend people, and people like that deserve to know each other. I was at your house when your friend Dennis was getting...
Other Dennis.
Wait. Okay, I'm not going to read that part, because that's...
Okay.
That's personal stuff about the other Dennis.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, my latest reason for wanting... Anyway, it was something about how great I am.
and when she's...
I'm lying. And that is not what it was about.
When she's talking about Elliot and Stuart, she's talking about the one of my favorite podcasts, The Flophouse.
Yes, yes. My latest reason for wanting to hear the three of you together is that I think your voices would sound amazing together. There are so many great reasons I think this would be great. There are so many reasons I think this would be great. Sorry. Thank you for your show. My favorite way to listen is when I'm folding my laundry. It just seems right. Well, that is appropriate.
Well, all I will say is stay tuned.
Well, what a teaser.
I know.
What a teaser you just gave. What's this? This is from Aaliyah. Am I saying that name correctly? Thank you for your excellent podcast. I found it through Pop Rocket and Who Shot Ya.
Oh, good.
I have a couple things. First, I feel like there are times when you are not super sensitive to issues surrounding women.
Hmm.
In no way do I think you're doing this purposely, and I think that when you do notice these issues, you handle them well. I just think that because you're both guys, you sometimes gloss over real feminist issues in films that I think are important. Like when a male actor is 20 years older than his female romantic pairing. Side note, I noticed that Mark Ruffalo consistently is paired with much younger women. I think in Now You See Me, The Avengers Begin Again, and I think he should be better. Anyway, I think you generally do pretty well. I just want more of these conversations to happen, and I think we shouldn't only rely on women to bring it up and discuss it, because that puts the burden of chipping away at sexism solely on us when it should be on everyone. I love the podcast, and I'm not trying to single you out, just something to think about.
Well, we try.
Okay, so...
Feel free to tell us when we've missed something in the future, because I would love some examples. And moving forward, if we fall short, please tell us, because this is an area in particular in which we really try to. I think that gay men have not been the ally to straight women or to women in general that they could be, and so I think we make an effort to, you know, talk about this stuff, and so please tell us when we don't.
Right. I mean, I've spent you know, my writing career as a film critic, sort of really trying to stay in tune with that.
Ditto.
And to notice stuff like that. So, because I don't know specifically which films you might be talking about, I don't know exactly how to address this, other than that, I mean, I think there have been times when we've noticed and talked about, you know, the discrepancy in age, you know, difference between leading men and and the women that are cast often just play the wife or girlfriend, whatever. So
we've been trying.
I'm trying.
We'll try to do better.
Please, again, specific. If you hear us not say something about something you think we should be saying something about, tell us.
Yeah,
because then we will.
We'll circle back.
It is as simple as that. If we miss something and you notice us missing something and you tell us, then we're going to swing back and talk about it.
Yeah.
And if we're too stupid to miss it the first time, it's because we're too stupid. We're trying not to be stupid.
Yeah.
Okay.
We want to be your comrades.
She continues, I'm also a baker.
Well.
And I was so excited when I realized that Dave shares my favorite hobby. I love hearing about your baking exploits, and I look forward to a time when I have an income to pay for linoleum knife and fork. I am a college freshman. I love when you share your baking, so here's a couple cakes I've made. Photos attached. Raspberry chocolate entremet? Do I even know what that is?
I don't know what an entremet is.
With meringue, chocolate cake with mousse filling and buttercream and piped chocolate butterflies. Oh, see, you're so much better than I am.
I like all of those words.
Already. These cakes look like you already work for a bakery. I'm looking. Oh my God, roses made out of frosting. I can't do any of this. Well, you're my teacher now, Aaliyah. I hope I'm saying your name right. Where can I find the back catalog? It doesn't seem to be any on any of the podcast apps.
Where can you
find our back
catalog? Usually, I know Apple Podcasts will go back about 50 episodes. I think they'll hold 50 episodes at a time.
But if you go to,
you can go to
Libsyn.
I was just about to say.
Okay, awesome.
Linoleum knife, all one word, .libsyn.com should have everything.
Going back to 2010.
Yes.
And those first episodes are rough. I don't know how far back you want
to
go.
Yeah. Like it took us a while to figure out how to make this sound come out of both ear holes.
Yeah, we weren't even in stereo at first.
We didn't know
what we were doing.
Yeah, we were in one earbud at a time. So,
and then we didn't know about editing, so we would just barrel through. There's one episode back from the first year where we have an actual, like, argument on the air. Do you remember this?
No.
It was not good either, and like I had to apologize to you. On the air, like, it was something, like, if that happened today,
we would stop and edit out,
but, like, we didn't even know how to do that back then, and so, like, I said something that actually hurt your feelings. I don't remember what it was.
I just remember
the feeling of mortification that it went out into the world and people were listening. Now, thankfully, at that time, there were only about 35 people listening.
Right.
But yeah, that's still out in the world.
Oh, brother. Anyway, yeah. So if you really, really want to dig in deep, yeah. Linoleumknife.libsyn.
Cakes are killing me.
.com.
You're so good at making cakes. I'll never be this good.
Oh.
Look at this ganache on top. It's so glossy and smooth and perfect.
You can ganache.
I can, but look at this one. With, like, the berries and the mounds and the things on it.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing. And you're a college freshman. I don't like you. You're too good at this.
Why don't you become her apprentice?
I need to become her apprentice. I'm like a 5-year-old in the kitchen compared to this.
Baby, your cakes are delicious.
Oh, they're delicious, yeah.
Even if they aren't, you know.
They aren't always as photogenic
visually
as anyone else's in the whole world. Thank you for these pictures. I'm going to dream of them now.
All right. Well, that's our show. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our theme music, Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Check out ChristyLemire.com. Go listen to Bibbs and Whitney on their shows, Canceled Too Soon, and Critically Acclaimed on the Schmoes Know Network. And, of course, check out Schmoes Know. Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, The Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy. Film Spotting SVU has ended.
Really?
Yes.
Do we know why?
I think they just had other fish to fry.
Mm.
But, yeah, Matt and Allison are great, but they are not doing their show anymore. So, anyway, I told you to go listen to it. I don't know if you ever did. Fat Guys, the movie is the Criterion cast, Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. Oh, that reminds me. We have new 5-star reviews.
Do we?
Yes.
Why don't you read a couple of them?
Yes, we should, totally. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places where we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. And they start sounding made up after all. There's literally one called iVoox. I think it's all in Spanish, but we are all, you can get
the
us
cling,
on.
Cling, clang, the ting, tang.
You can
the get florp, it. Floop.
You can get us on Florp, Floop. Leave
the
us.
The hickety doo, or whatever you said at the beginning of the show.
Hang on, where are those reviews? Because they are worth sharing. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at LinoleumCast, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
Okay, so let's see. The 18th letter says, as a black man who saw Solo and stayed throughout the entire movie, Dave, winky emoticon.
Yeah, well.
The notion that the writers
I walked out. I paid my money. I get to walk out whenever I want.
That's right. You're voting with your feet. The notion that the writer slash director slash actor that portrayed the android as a female, quote, sassy black character is ridiculous.
Now, that is a reference to another letter that someone wrote asking if we thought that the female robot character
was intended to be
a caricature in the vein of Jar Jar Binks.
Right.
And we said, we didn't think so.
Yeah, but we said we would leave it to black listeners to tell
us. Black listeners to tell us this. Yes.
Her woke persona could and can be applied to many other groups besides African Americans. We aren't the only people that have needed liberation. And as far as her robot hips, well, I saw Incredibles 2. I will add this, though. I can only speak for myself, and unlike Jesse Jackson, I don't speak for all black people. If I were having Jar Jar flashbacks, I would have immediately walked out right behind Dave.
That is not why I walked out, by the way.
No.
I walked out because I was bored out of my gourd. And because I knew the minute someone said something about the Kessel Run, I thought, gee, I wonder how this movie's going to end.
PR Julie says, love the nested parentheses of conversations that include food, relationships, and, oh yeah, movies. Mary Bennett is feminist icon, that's her full name, says, I love these guys. Listening to them is like having coffee with a fun and super knowledgeable couple. You always feel like you've learned something about film and got to sit in on their kitchen table talk. The banter is so authentic, it could only come from a couple who've been together for a hot minute. I look forward to every show.
It is currently a very hot minute.
It's a very hot minute right now.
And
Seth Kino says, as a one-time film major and film reviewer, I actually only found out about Linoleum Knife by accident when Alonzo Duraldi and Dave White were both on the Pop Rocket podcast. Yep. I forget if they were both on at the same time.
We were not.
Were we never on at the same time?
Nope.
Interesting.
Nope.
I wound up listening to Linoleum Knife all the time in the car.
Unless I'm completely wrong and misremembering, but I don't think we've ever been on at the same time on Pop Rocket.
I cannot remember. I'll have to look.
No.
I wound up listening to Linoleum Knife all the time in the car instead of the radio. What I love about the podcast is that all films are considered equally, from an Agnes Varda film to My Little Pony. They even brought in an expert on My Little Pony.
Because I didn't go see My Little Pony. I didn't want to go see My Little Pony.
And I needed Johnny Jungle Guts to walk me through it. Dave White loves an Avengers movie as much as the 5-hour Japanese film about a group of friends to those Romanian movies you will probably never hear of elsewhere. And the duo are man-married, as am I, and make sure to announce this at the top of the show, which
most of the time
which I like, since there are many podcasts with obviously gay hosts and it never seems to get mentioned, even in instances when it should be.
Oh, there are podcasts that I listen to where I thought for a long time that the hosts were gay, and then I find out, oh no, they're not.
They're not
at all.
They're just, you know, they just got some sugar in them.
They just exactly. Some heterosexual men do have a little sugar in
them, and more power to them.
Thank God and evolution for that.
I also love the non-film banter and discussions about movie houses in LA and the DVD recommendations. Well, thank all of you for that. If you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, we will read your review on the air as well.
Is there anything else to talk about?
That is it.
Oh, hey, do you want to buy a Linoleum Knife t-shirt? Do you, Alonzo Duralde, want to buy a Linoleum Knife t-shirt? No? Maybe someone else does.
Someone else might.
Maybe someone who's listening wants to buy a Linoleum Knife t-shirt. This is the original black t-shirt. It's just a black t-shirt. It says Linoleum Knife in white, authoritative design letters.
In a strict font.
And they're $22.
Within the United States.
Within the United States. They're a little more if you live in a far-flung location out in the rest of the world. You could email us about that. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com is how you get one.
Yep.
You can email me there, tell me your size, and I'll give you the information about how to do the PayPal thing.
You can PayPal us at that email address, and then, you know, include information about...
Well, don't PayPal us until you ask me if we have your size.
Good point. Okay, fine.
Yes.
Email us first, and then once we give you the go-ahead, pay us.
Yeah. If you are a subscriber to Linoleum Knife Patreon, and you are a person who still doesn't have your stuff...
Or you have questions about sizes or whatnot?
Yep. D. Leland White, 1964. That is the letter D, as in Dave. Leland is my middle name. L-E-L-A-N-D, like Leland Palmer, who killed his daughter on Twin Peaks.
Or was it Bob?
It was Leland. D. Leland White, 1964, at gmail.com.
So.
The end.
Make it so. All right.
How long have we been going on for now?
This is a 90-minute episode.
Okay, we gave you a lot of...
My laptop is scorching.
Lengthy content today.
All right, we will catch all of y'all next week. Until then.
Goodbye.